Telling you a funny story that happened with my younger son Ronan last night as I was going over this talk with him and my husband while my other son was not awake, we'll say. He was awake, but he wasn't present. And he said, "Mommy, that's not a talk, that's a speech." He said, anything more than a few minutes is when you're speaking without interacting is a speech. And I said, no, Ronan, this is a talk. And I explained what this was about. But he said, and I said, if you come to the Zendo or if you're engaged in other activities in your life where you get to go and listen to others share their experience or their practice, you'll hear what are called talks. And he said, "No, I won't, because I'll just leave." Bless you, this isn't a speech. He just things down to paper as I prepared for this, mostly in the historical framework of how this particular program that I'm going to share with you came to be. So some of it will be read to you more or less, more casually how it unfolds in my life. So bear with me as I place my second eyes on and look down a little bit at my paper. So, as long as I can remember, I've wanted to help others. Some may say this is my ancient and twisted karma, to right the willful ignorance of my many ancestors. Regardless of the reasons, I could not turn away. You see, I got a second chance, and I knew it was time for me to give back. The privilege of my life would only make sense if I served others. But that's a different talk, one that would pay homage to teachers like Jack Kornfield and Noah Levine. Today, I've been invited to speak to you about how I practice with the world, how I cultivate engaged activity. I don't see my practice as something separate from the rest of my life. It is indeed why I was drawn to this path, because there is no separation. And so, with this second chance, I was very deliberate in the choosing of my livelihood and began working in the social services in many different capacities, and eventually found my way to working with children in schools. I was hired by the Vancouver School Board in 2011 as a youth and family worker. And at the same time, I was also hired as a special needs education assistant. And I've been doing both of those streams ever since. It was in my first year that I found myself at Seymour Elementary in Vancouver's downtown east side, and I knew that's where I wanted to serve. I've worked there ever since. Mindfulness, sati in Pali, is one of the seven factors of enlightenment. Samasati is the seventh enlightenment of the Buddha's Eightfold Path, thorough awareness, right mindfulness of things, oneself, feelings, thought, people, and reality. Mindfulness as a modern Western secular practice is founded on the training of sati, which means moment-to-moment awareness of present events, and also to remember to be aware without judgment, to simply be awake to life as it is. In 1979, Jon Kabat-Zinn founded mindfulness-based stress reduction program in the hopes that mindful meditation would prove to be of benefit in the rigid science and fact world of medicine. This would be the early spark that would set in motion the ever-growing interest and application of meditation and mindfulness in medicine, and neuroscience would start to actually be able to measure those benefits that the ancient sages and rishis knew for thousands of years. And so mindfulness-based training and other similar programs have been cropping up all over and are now widely used in hospitals, treatment centers, prisons, and schools. One such school-based program was born here in Vancouver in 2005, when the first mindfulness training was held at UBC with Dr. Kim Schonert-Reichel, Molly Lawler, and members of the Hahn Foundation. The Hahn Foundation is a foundation that was founded by Goldie Hahn. Following that, there was a research initiative, the first of many, to look at the effects of mindfulness on school-aged children. Since that initial training, there were several mindful education programs, and now in Vancouver, the program is called Mind Up. And curriculums were developed by the Hahn Foundation and then taken over by Scholastic and packaged very nicely, and there's many versions of these, and I can certainly make this available for you to look at later on. Due to its popularity with educators, the initiative grew very quickly, especially in Vancouver, and today Mind Up can be found in many of the elementary and high school classrooms in Vancouver. I just need to make note, however, that while it's been embraced for the most part, there have been concerns about it, the potential for it to be not so secular, and there has been some backlash by parents that are concerned that it has its roots in Buddhism, and so we navigate that on an individual basis, and are very clear that this isn't something that we're trying to indoctrinate children into anything but the benefits of especially mindful breathing, which I'll get into later on. While I don't need to tell you, this audience, the uses of mindfulness and who needs mindfulness, it's hopeful to me that educators are appreciating the benefits for young people. Schools are busy, often chaotic places, placing lots of demands on kids to perform. We ask a lot of kids, young children just emerging into the wider world, often just becoming aware that there is something greater than their immediate surroundings, and older children stretched in all directions as they try to navigate and straddle the many different worlds, real and virtual. Children are no strangers to the stress from an early age. The experience of stress ranges in sources and from the pressures to achieve are high. For others, it is economic hardship, poor nutrition, inadequate health care, and for others still, it may be linked to emotional deprivation or limited educational resources. Whatever the particular circumstance of any of these factors, they can hamper a child's ability to learn without anxiety. And in communities like the one I work in, children backpacks are full. Mindfulness addresses these obstacles to productive learning by offering children and teachers simple practices and insights that become tools for self-management and self-regulation, which is the big buzzword in education these days. Self-regulate, through social-emotional learning. So what does mindfulness look like in schools? Well, I can tell you what it looks like at my school and others, but I'll stick to what I've been practicing or getting to practice with the kids. Of course, the core practice is called mindful breathing, done individually with another student or as a whole class or school-wide. I get to lead the entire school during assemblies. And in the classroom I worked in for 4 years, we practiced mindful breathing together at least 3 times a day. Once to start our day, once after recess, to let go of all of the social navigations that one might encounter on the playground, and to get ready to be learning in the classroom again, and for the same reasons following lunch. We typically use a chime, so again, a very basic tool, but one that is not evoking Tibetan bowls or what have you, although I have brought mine in to share with the children. And that's certainly something that the children really like to participate in, and I'm always working towards the children leading the mindful breathing, depending on the teacher that I work with, whether they're open to that. And so, as I said, it's led by usually the teacher, and the group is invited simply to close their eyes or look down at their hands. And choice is a huge factor in this, in that, again, when we have parents that are resistant to this idea that it's not something that children are forced to do, and if they choose not to participate, that's absolutely okay, so long as they're respectful of others that are engaged in that activity. There is one school that is piping it through their PA system regularly, and that brings up other questions of choice, but I digress in that. You can imagine what that might involve. Different classes are involved in different things at different times. So the other things that I get to explore with the kids are the way we sit. So you'll notice that I like to sit in a different position than the traditional crisscross way of sitting in Zazen. So I always show the kids that, and I call this hero's pose or superhero's pose as one of the kids. And then the way we place our hands is another option. There's many different forms, and I don't use the word mudra when I explain that. And but often I notice that children do very often like to bring their hands to their heart center, and I invite them to also notice their simple beating of their hearts. And as a yogi, I do often, without making reference to that, mention that to bring awareness to their spine and to create space and to lift the crown of their head and so forth. So there's a lot at play there to get settled. But as a daily practice, then eventually the children begin to know to take their seat or to find their comfortable position, and then we can get right to it. And the whole process only lasts a few minutes at most. And it acts as a wedge in their day, a space that gives an opportunity for quiet and focus of their nervous system to rebalance. And naturally, the kindergartners are the best at this. And I say that because they have no inhibitions. When you invite them to take a breath and close their eyes, they'll look like this. And they'll breathe deeply like this. It is an absolutely brilliant. And as little ones, and it's really cool to see how they have taken this practice into their lives and are very comfortable and familiar with it. So beautiful one that just, it's called Tenders. Yes. And shrink. You know, the free campus, which are the most